It's the 1% election solution of Radio Free Thinker. This week, ceases new powers, little oversight. Politics as propaganda, the 1% electoral strategy. The politics of fear, foreign policy, profits over principles, and the CBC's The Agenda gives us their 2 cents worth about the politics of fear. Let's begin episode 295.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about the Harper government, like duh. In particular, a few of its recent actions. Let's start off with the newly passed Bill C-51, the Let's Make Everyone a Terrorist Bill. We had hopes a few weeks back when the government signaled it would make some amendments to the legislation, that the more onerous parts, the more dangerous aspects would be ameliorated. But alas, when the bill was rammed through Parliament, few effective changes were made, and many of the most alarming aspects remain. I say rammed, but that's not fair. Only the NDP and the Greens rejected the bill, and what has become a more illuminating view of the soul of the Liberal Party that seems to side with Harper against the people of Canada. The Liberals helped pass C-51 with the promise to fix the flawed bill if they were elected. You know, wink wink, nudge nudge, vote Liberal. Get it, folks? A cheap political stunt that should have fooled no one. So a couple of weeks ago, Harper had announced that they would, as part of the regular parliamentary committee review of Bill C-51, do a clause-by-clause assessment of the bill. They did amend the language, changing one line that defined what an act of terrorism was. Well, the original line stated that, quote, for greater certainty, it does not include lawful advocacy, protest, dissent, and artistic expression. The word lawful would have made most forms of civil disobedience an act of terrorism under this law. Why? Well, this meant that anyone who protested in an unlawful way could be charged as a terrorist. Remember from our previous show, we pointed out that many protests, like those disrupting traffic, chaining oneself to a fence, these are technically unlawful, but acts that we as a society deem acceptable, at least in a limited way, as part of legitimate protest. So now the line is, for greater certainty, it does not include advocacy, protest, dissent, and artistic expression, i.e. they drop the word lawful. So I'm going to chalk this one up as a win. A bridge too far, maybe, for the government, at least for now. Post a Harper win this fall, I would not be surprised if this language is amended again. They remove the arresting powers of CSIS agent, but still will allow them to, quote, disrupt terrorist activities. Well, activities they deem terrorist. Of course, one must wonder what powers are granted to disrupt. If they can't arrest you and they're not allowed to kill you, does this mean that they're going to go out and break kneecaps? I mean, really, we don't know. Yes, I have an active imagination, but hopefully CSIS doesn't, because it will have the power to break the law. What, you might say? That's ridiculous. They can't break the law, ignore human rights. Well, under this legislation, they can go to a court and get permission to break any law, contravene any right, all in the name of security. I don't know about you, but I suddenly feel less secure, less safe. That said, at least they need a warrant. Or do they? Again, the wording is important. They need only get a warrant if they know that their actions will break a law or contravene one of our supposedly constitutionally protected human rights. It's up to their discretion as to whether or not they have crossed this line or not. With a warrant, they are given a get-out-of-jail-free card, or a the-law-does-not-apply-to-you card, if you will. Hope you can sleep well tonight. Well, here's something that may help you sleep a little easier. The law does prohibit CSIS from inflicting bodily harm, even with a warrant. So no, they're not going to be coming after your kneecaps. Maybe just your freedom. Wow, 3 whole amendments passed out of over 150 proposed. You can guess how many conservative amendments there were. 3. And how many from the NDP and the other opposition parties? Well, that's what made up the over 150 proposal part. But only the cons were accepted. Anyway, previously the law gave the Minister of Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness the power to, quote, direct an air carrier to do anything that, in the minister's opinion, is reasonable and necessary to prevent a listed person from engaging in an act of terrorism. The word anything has been removed and the line changed to read, the minister may direct an air carrier to take a specific, reasonable, and necessary action to prevent a listed person from engaging in any act of terrorism. Oh yes, I should add that Harper also stated prior to committee review that they may reduce the amount of information sharing CSIS can undertake, although I think this sort of to be the least offensive. They are an intelligence collection agency, and they are tasked with gathering information and forwarding pertinent information to proper agencies like the RCMP. Of course, the fears are that we'll have another Mararar, the Canadian citizen who was shipped off to Syria, back when Syria was sort of a torture subcontractor of the CIA, where he was tortured for over a year because of the information the government's own commission called inaccurate and unfair, supplied by Canadian officials, i.e. the RCMP, and likely CSIS, to the U.S. government officials in the CIA. This also should be a warning to those who say that they don't care about surveillance state because they have nothing to hide. Arar had done nothing wrong, and he was arrested and tortured for over a year. Of course, it's not so much that they collect the information. To some degree, we can all agree law enforcement agencies should have access to information. No, the real problem is accountability. If you give unlimited power without any oversight, and have no one or way to ensure that there's no abuse of that power, well, there's a problem. And that is one thing the government did not change, the oversight of CSIS. Especially with its new powers, one would think that important. It is something the NDP is ensuring people know about. Currently, CSIS has no oversight. It does have a review process, the Security Intelligence Review Committee, or CIRC, whose role it is to review the activities of CSIS to assure that the extraordinary powers granted the security services are, quote, used legally and appropriately, and in order to protect Canadians' rights and freedoms. Nothing wrong with that, right? Until you realize the committee only meets once a month, so not very timely. Is composed of only 5 members, and even now they're actually short a member, so not really a comprehensive review. That the members are appointed by the PMO, so not really impartial, and of course there's no parliamentary oversight. That is, no elected member is allowed to review CSIS activity, making them innately unaccountable to the people of Canada. Even the US has the CIA and FBI report and answer questions to Senate oversight committees. Just so you know how unusual that is for a mature democracy like we have, at least for now, yes, Harper, I'm thinking of you, Canada is the only country in the Five Eyes Intelligence Network, which includes Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the US, not to have some kind of proactive parliamentary oversight of its spy agency. Harper says there's already enough oversight. And again, I should point out there is no oversight. It is all review. After the fact, there is no accountability about what CSIS does or will do. All of it is focused on what it has already done. The horses out of the barn kind of oversight. And CIRC has itself reported that CSIS has willfully misled it in the past. There's smoke there, folks. We should see if there's any fire, no? Now, of course, this has been the cause championed by Thomas Mulcair, leader of the NDP, as well as his party. And you might dismiss this as sort of political posturing. But a letter signed by 4 former prime ministers, one of which was conservative, as well as 5 former Supreme Court justices, several former ministers of justice, members of the CSIS review committee, and others have all said that while increasing CSIS power, the bill should also implement the recommendations made by a committee commissioned to review what went wrong in the Arar case. Quick note, the then opposition critic Peter McKay also supported the proposed changes to the 2006 legislation to increase CSIS accountability, legislation that died with the fall of the Martin government. The letter states that protecting human rights and protecting public safety are complementary objectives, but experience has shown that serious human rights abuses can occur in the name of maintaining national security. In fact, instead of strengthening CSIS oversight, Harper abolished the position of CSIS Inspector General, an internal watchdog, in an effort to save $1 million. As well, according to many observers, including former members of CERC, beyond more funding, the one power which is needed to truly keep an eye on CSIS activity is to expand the scope of where it can investigate. What I mean is, the members of CERC have commented that while investigating CSIS, they run into invisible walls. That because CSIS engages other partners in order to get the information they need, that may well involve Canadian border and security agencies, CSEC, the RCMP, etc., they have no authority to follow threads that may lead outside of CSIS, and that means they cannot truly scrutinize CSIS's activities. There is an irony that CSIS has the power to investigate anywhere, but the committee charged with oversight of CSIS is restricted where it can go. On an important but somewhat tangential note, I find it a colossal example of misreporting by the press who keep repeating, along with the government, that Bill C-51 has the support of the majority of Canadians. Based on what? A poll. And how exactly does that poll go? Well, you too can now take the poll. Here are the questions. Some people say there is a serious threat of terrorism in Canada. Others believe this threat has been overblown by politicians and the media. Which of these two views is closest to your own? There is a serious threat of terrorism in Canada, or politicians and the media have overblown the threat of terrorism in Canada? Well, let's stop here. You, my loyal listeners, have been fortunate to have an alternative news source like Radio Free Thinker, so you know that there's more hype than danger to the smokescreen presented as a terrorist threat. Those who rely on mainstream media may believe that the threat is not only obvious, to use Harper's favorite word these days, but increasing. But let's be honest, terrorism is in one form or another, is just a part of life and has been for centuries. For those with short memories, we should recall a real terrorist threat during the FLQ crisis in the 70s, and no new laws were needed then. So it's not surprising that the majority of Canadians agree this threat is a real possibility. So the next question asks people if they are familiar with the legislation, and most said they are. But this is a common problem with polling. Most people do not want to admit they don't know something. So we cannot be confident that people know enough about the issue to have an informed opinion. The next question asks whether people explicitly support or oppose specific acts such as make it illegal to promote terrorism, block internet sites promoting terrorism, make it easier to put terrorist suspects on the no-fly list, that kind of thing. Not surprising, most people are in favor. I am unsure how you would defend saying that you support sites promoting terrorism, or you'd like to give terrorists free access to flying. A better question would have been, do you support a no-fly list intended to prevent terrorist travel, even if that means you may accidentally be placed on that list? I'm sure you'd get a slightly different response. The poll asked if there should be more oversight of police agencies or not. To this, the vast majority think that there should be additional oversights so that, quote, these agencies do not go overboard with these new powers. Now, every poll has a tell, a question where they guide you to the answer they want, and this next one is this poll's tell. The question goes like this. What is your overall view of the overall balance between security concerns and Canadians' freedom and privacy under the new anti-terrorism legislation? Would you say this proposed legislation is, and there are three potential answers, one, goes way too far, not enough protection for freedom and privacy, or strikes the right balance overall, or does not go nearly far enough, and this is where you can see that this poll was either overtly or implicitly commissioned by the Conservatives, it actually reads in completion, does not go nearly far enough, if you're not a terrorist, you have nothing to hide. Wow. We have already discussed in past shows regarding government surveillance how loaded and false this line is. Just ask Mayor Arar if this is true. So most people naively agree that if you have nothing to hide, you should have nothing to fear. But of course, being put on the defensive, you're either with us or the terrorist. The next question, do you trust these law enforcement agencies? The majority says yes. It then concludes, do you support Bill C-51? Well, you just said you had nothing to hide and that you trust the government, so obviously you support the bill. Now you might say, Don, what are you talking about? No one was tricked. It's a poll. This is what people really think. Well, then I have to ask you about the logical contradiction this poll shows. Remember they asked, do you think there needs to be more oversight to prevent abuse? And almost 70% said yes. You don't think you need oversight if you trust an agency. You want oversight because you don't trust them. Here's a clip from Yes Minister about how polls can be used as political weapons.
He's going to say something new and radical in the broadcast.
What, that silly grand design? Bernard, that was precisely what you had to avoid. How did this come about? I shall need a very good explanation.
Well, he's very keen on it.
What's that got to do with it? Things don't happen just because prime ministers are very keen on them. Neville Chamberlain was very keen on peace.
He thinks it's a vote winner.
Ah, that's more serious. Sit down. What makes him think that?
Well, the party have had an opinion poll done. It seems all the voters are in favour of bringing back national service.
Well, have another opinion poll done showing the voters are against bringing back national service.
Well, they can't be for it and against.
Of course they can, Bernard. Have you ever been surveyed?
Yes. Well, not me, actually. My house. Oh, I see what you mean.
Well, Bernard, you know what happens. Nice young lady comes up to you. Obviously, you want to create a good impression. You don't want to look a fool, do you?
No.
No. So she starts asking you some questions. Mr. Woolley, are you worried about the number of young people without jobs?
Yes.
Are you worried about the rise in crime among teenagers?
Yes.
Do you think there's a lack of discipline in our comprehensive schools?
Yes.
Do you think young people welcome some authority and leadership in their lives?
Yes.
Do you think they respond to a challenge?
Yes.
Would you be in favour of reintroducing national service? Yes.
Oh, well, I suppose I might.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Of course you would, Bernard. After all you've told you, you can't say no to that. So, they don't mention the first five questions, they publish the last one.
Is that really what they do?
Well, not the reputable ones, no, but there aren't many of those. So, alternatively, the young lady can get the opposite result.
How?
Mr. Woolley, are you worried about the danger of war?
Yes.
Are you worried about the growth of armaments?
Yes.
Do you think there's a danger in giving young people guns and teaching them how to kill?
Yes.
Do you think it's wrong to force people to take up arms against their will?
Yes.
Would you oppose the reintroduction of national service?
Yes.
There you are, you see, Bernard. The perfect balanced sample. So, we just commission our own survey for the Ministry of Defence. See to it, Bernard.
So as every election in the last many years has shown us, polling means nothing beyond a good soundbite for corporate media, and on occasion, a useful piece of propaganda for the ruling party. And that reminds me, a loyal listener to Radio Free Thinker brought this to my attention. Let me quote some parts written in the comments section of a Sun newspaper report. A man wrote that he was 65 years old, retiree, and he was just as safe now as the day he was born. And so are you. We are just as safe now as our parents and our grandparents. And I might add, with the end of the Cold War, the defeat of the Nazis, one could argue much, much safer. He goes on to say, read your history. The barbarians have always been knocking at the gates. So why is our neoconservative Harper government so eager to mimic its American cousins with all this expensive code red BS by proposing Big Brother's Bill C-51 and the infrastructure needed to construct it, and by the way, not to control it? When Air India Flight 182 became the largest mass murder in Canadian history, killing 268 Canadians in 1985, did our government and citizens go berserk on the Sikh communities? Since this disaster was attributed to a militant ties to that religious group? No. Did we feel the need to remove our right to privacy? No. Did CSIS need Bill C-51 in order to stop the Toronto 18 terrorist plot? No. If the entire security team in Ottawa's Parliament Hill last year weren't having a coffee break when that madman stormed through, Harper would not have wet his pants and reacted by tabling such an aggressive bill. Will Bill C-51 remove the threats to our society that crazy lone wolves are planning right now? No. Our parents and our grandparents fought and some died in order to preserve our way of life, to protect our freedoms, and it is ridiculous to even think that our liberties can be protected by removing them. He who trades liberty for security gains neither. Now, let's pretend that maybe there is a greater risk. And this is a thought that we'll talk about on the other side of this break. So we'll be back right after this.
science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We're back. So, what if there is a greater risk? If there is a greater risk from terrorism in Canada, one must ask why. Well, first, there is the complete trashing of Canada's reputation on the international stage as politically neutral, a trusted, unbiased middle power. Harper has, in his short term as our dear leader, never turned down an opportunity to show that we are the most reactionary, ultra-right-wing, ideological-driven nation in the world. He has pledged undying loyalty to the Jewish nation of Israel. I added Jewish nation because in case you thought he supported the democratic nation, no, Harper is quick to throw the Palestinians and Arabs under the bus in order to stand behind Bibi and his ultra-right-wing government, being one of the first to call and congratulate Netanyahu on his come-from-behind electoral victory in the recent Israeli elections. And that leads to my next whine this week. How can we, as a liberal, democratic, dare I say civilized nation, still support the Israeli government, and in particular, Netanyahu, who, in his successful attempt to swing the election his way, is following a playbook of Harper? Well, to be fair, it's hard to see who's following who, but they both are using the politics of fear, the demonization of a minority, so as to scare people into voting for them. Netanyahu, or Bibi, as he's also known, has been for years cultivating this existential fear of the Arabs, of Iran, so that he can come out and proclaim the only savior for this manufactured boogeyman is himself. And ironically enough, and probably to plan, with his electoral success, the flames of hatred towards Israel do increase. It becomes a sort of positive feedback loop. Fear creates uncertainty, uncertainty creates fear, and the cycle fuels itself, ultimately ending in death and destruction for the weakest. And in this case, it's the Palestinians. In the lead-up to the election, the Israeli Minister of Foreign Affairs stated that any disloyal Israeli Arab should be beheaded. This was followed up by Bibi stating that there would be no Palestinian state under his watch, which of course contradicts his stated position and the position of the rest of the world of a two-state solution. And he ended his election campaign warning Jews that the nation of Israel was at risk because, quote, the Arabs are voting in droves, and you better get out and vote for him or, I don't know, the Holocaust or something? Now that he's actually formed a government that includes the ultra-Zionist Jewish Homeland Party that has demanded increased settlement action in the West Bank, it's Minister of Justice who opines that there's too much democracy in Israel and that the non-Jews have too many rights. And it's Minister of Civilian Administration who has said Palestinians are animals, they're not humans, they should not be entitled to live. So egregious were the comments of Bibi et al. That even the U.S. has stated that it is reevaluating their support of Israel. This will likely only be a symbolic rebuke, like not vetoing the Security Council calls for the end of illegal, as in war crime level illegal settlements in the West Bank, or the end of the siege of Gaza, or call for a two-state solution. It's funny, it shows the level of hypocrisy of the U.S. that while Obama was calling for an end of the bombardment of the civilians in Gaza last year, he simultaneously opened up the American Strategic Reserve to resupply Israel with bombs when they ran out halfway through its campaign. And I say halfway, it might have been the end of the slaughter had Obama just said no. Obama, just say no. Next time, and there will little doubt be a next time. The Israeli government has actually a name for what it does in Gaza. They call it cutting the grass. But let us remember, the grass in this context that they're mowing down are mainly innocent Palestinians. And recently, a number of army officials have come out and made explicit what most people kind of knew, that the only reason needed to kill in Gaza was, well, to be in Gaza. The logic went something like this. Only a terrorist would be stupid enough to stay here. So if they're here, they are, by definition, enemy combatants, and you can shoot them. They pointed out that when firing tank rounds, random targets were bombed. What the fuck, people? It is this person, Bibi, the incarnation of the racist apartheid Israeli state, to which Harper has pledged Canadian support no matter what he does. That I find offensive on so many levels. Harper would likely side with Hitler if he thought it would win him votes. And that may be the reason for Harper's irrational and immoral support of Israel. Votes. Harper seems to have acknowledged that he will never win a majority in Canada. By that I mean a majority of the votes. The last time a government accomplished that particular feat was in 1984. So his strategy seems to be to win enough 1% to capture the required number of ridings to have a majority of seats in Parliament. This is how he won the majority of seats this last time. He won 54% of the seats, but with only 39% of the popular vote. To put that in context, the NDP got 30% of the vote, and ironically enough, 30% of the seats. But that 9%, the difference between the NDP and the Cons, well, that translated into 24% of the seats, the difference between a minority government and a majority government. And it is that 9% that Harper is focused on. He knows his foolish, immoral, unlimited support of Israel will give him one of those 9%, the Jewish vote. His radical support of Ukraine, that got him another 1%. His economically irrational income splitting plan, another 1%. And sadly, his plan is working. I was again listening to a call-in show where a new Canadian was gushing about how he would follow to Harper to hell and back because of his support of Kurdistan, for saving the lives of the Kurds. That kind of explains his actions in Iraq and Syria. And there's another 1%. And this leads me to my last one of this week. What the hell are we doing in Syria? And now the Ukraine? We were smart the first time around and declined to enter into the ill-advised disaster that was the Iraqi invasion that led to the occupation of Iraq, which quickly led to what is commonly called the Iraqi quagmire. And now that it's a complete pig's breakfast, Harper thinks this is the time for us to send military troops and fighter jets. Why? Well, to stop terrorism, of course. Is my flag pin on straight? Cue the nationalistic music. The words of one caller into the CBC radio show and a Republican mantra, we either fight them over there or we fight them here. I really wish I was making this stuff up. Yes, here in Canada we have idiots spouting propaganda like that. What has Harper done to this once proud great nation? Okay, back to the Cons mantra, there are here. Of course, if we were not fighting them on their soil, there would be no incentive for them to come and fight on ours. It has been our involvement in Iraq that has made us a target. We first committed to sending advisors in September of last year. We announced sending fighter jets at the start of October, and within a few weeks of that, we got our first lone wolf attack, quickly followed by another. But would that have happened if we had not taken on a military posture in the first place? Harper is apparently trying to cut spending wherever he can. CBC, who needs it? Canada Post, yesterday's news. Social programming, well, those are for the weak. Tax cuts, yes sir, can I have another? Handouts to big oil and any corporation. Yes, that's how we get big donations. But when it was estimated that for every hour our fighter jets flies, it costs about 17 grand. And how many missions have we flown? How many millions have we wasted on this mission? I believe the number being bandied around is about $500 million is being pissed away on military actions in Iraq and now Syria. I'm not going to count the humanitarian support or even the military supplies we have donated to the Kurds and the Iraqis. Those might make a difference. They show moral support. But our six lonely fighter jets are not going to do anything except make us a new target to radical Islam, whatever that is. It is like Trudeau had said, I think. Harper is trying to prove that his jets are bigger than theirs. Harper is the kind of fortune teller who predicts you're about to be hit on the head and then takes a hammer out and hits you on the head. A self-fulfilling prophecy. He predicts that terrorism is a threat and then he does actions that actually makes them a threat to us. And now we've sent training advisors to the Ukraine, with emphasis that they will be posted on the far side of Ukraine, far from the fighting Russian forces. And yes, I say Russian and not separatist forces, because the comments made by Putin, well, this is a poorly veiled attempt by the Russian president to create a buffer zone, at best, a new vassal state, at worst, out of eastern Ukraine. And yes, who knows what this might mean for other Russian border states. especially those with sizable ethnic Russian populations like the Baltic state. So I find this more defensible. In fact, there's a weird consistency that is with the new militarized Canada. In the past, well, in the present as well, the U.S. has been sort of the global cop, the one to send in troops where needed, well, where it serves U.S. policy. But it seems Harper has a taste for the ultra-violence, to the point that if there's a conflict anywhere in the world, regardless of the merits of the cause or the value of our military involvement, well, Harper sends in the troops. What I lament is that in the past, we would have not sent in troops. We would have sent in diplomats, negotiators, using soft power to defuse global hotspots, not send in troops to aggravate them. Canada had mastered for decades the art of soft power, and we're globally recognized as a fair broker in conflicts. In fact, we invented peacekeepers. Let us remember it was a Canadian resolution to the UN Security Council that created peacekeepers, and Prime Minister Lester B. Pearson did receive the Nobel Prize for brokering an end to the Suez Crisis in 1956. But no, now instead of trying to find a peaceful resolution to world's conflicts, we send in fighter jets, we send in military environments, we get dead bodies. Does Harper really think that Russia can be defeated on the battlefield? What is his endgame? I can tell you his endgame. It is this October in the elections. It's the battle for those 1% that he is going after, to hell with how much it might cost in money, reputations, or lives. And we've already seen a body bag count containing Canadian soldiers in Syria, soon maybe from Ukraine. Where else might he intervene? A quick look at the demographic and electoral map of Canada should show us. Well, that's a job a bit above my pay grade, but it is interesting to note that stats can say that 70% of established immigrants from Africa vote, compared to a national average of about 60%. And if you trust that agency to have factual information since the end of the mandatory long-form census was done away with by the Harper government, well, Nigeria might be our next military adventure. Lots of votes there. I'm going to close this segment with the fact that when the Liberals are not supporting the cons, they are parroting the NDP line. Either way, in whatever party you support, we must put an end to this constant downward spiral that the Harper regime has taken this nation. We are on the eve of an election, an opportunity, perhaps our last one, to regain a measure of control over our nation, to save this Canada that we all love so much. 2015, never forget. We'll be back after this break.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
And we're back. You know, there's a theme here, that Harper is not the most principled of people, but then again, he claims to be very principled in his actions. Well, one must wonder if Harper's principled foreign policy is empty rhetoric for profits or just votes. Recently, there was a moment of clarity, a lifting of the veil, the taking of the other path, when Swedish and Canadian foreign policies were critiqued. You see, both countries have been criticized for their stance on selling arms to Saudi Arabia, with the Canadian government defending its decision to supply light armored vehicles, or LAVs, to a country with one of the worst human rights records in the world. So wherein lies the critique? Well, Sweden recently elected a new government, and one of its accomplishments was to cancel its armed deal with the Gulf state. Prime Minister Stephen Harper describes Canada's foreign policy as principled, though he is less clear about what these principles are. In contrast, Sweden, a country often compared to Canada as reflecting similar social and political values, defines its foreign policy as explicitly feminist. In 2014, the Canadian government signed its largest ever export deal worth about $14.8 billion to supply LAVs to Saudi Arabia. Canada has supplied LAVs to Saudi Arabia since 1993, with exports increasing over the last few years. The Canadian government says the new deal will generate 3,000 advanced manufacturing jobs for 14 years, as well as thousands of other jobs for suppliers. Saudi Arabia is currently Canada's second largest export market in the Middle East, and will now be the largest recipient of Crown Corporation brokered military export contracts, surpassing the U.S. for the first time. However, Canada has a law, if not principles, regarding whom it can export weapons. Under the Canadian Export and Import Permits Act, the government can only provide export permits for arms to, quote, governments that have a persistent record of serious violations of human rights of their citizen, unless it can be demonstrated that there is no reasonable risk that the goods might be used against the civilian population. Nicholas Marsh, who researched arms transfers at the Peace Research Institute of Oslo, notes the Saudi government has little credibility in terms of human rights commitments. Marsh said, "I don't think that the assurances from the Saudi government have much weight. It is likely Saudi Arabia used Canadian-made labs to squash peaceful demonstrations for democratic reform in Bahrain in 2011. And it was Bahrain where the Arab Spring died. And it seems, in part, thanks to our labs." Citing Saudi Arabia's dismal human rights record, NDP foreign affairs critic Paul Dewar called on the Harper government to release its deliberations regarding the recent deal. In response, Francis LaSalle, spokesperson for the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, stated, quote, "For reasons of commercial confidentiality, the Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade and Development does not comment on specific applications." The department has refused to provide any further details, including how many vehicles will be supplied, what types of arms the vehicles include, and what, if any, assurances it has from the Saudis that they will not be used against civilians. The government has prioritized corporate rights at the expense of human rights, of human lives. In contrast, Sweden has prioritized women's rights and political freedom. Swedish Foreign Minister Margot Wallström announced last month that Sweden would not renew an arms deal with Saudi Arabia that was set to expire in May. She denounced the Saudi authorities for their disregard for women's rights and for the sentencing of Saudi blogger Rafi Badawi, whose wife and family coincidentally happened to live in Canada, to 10 years in prison, 1,000 lashes, and a fine of over $250,000 for criticizing Saudi clerics. Talk about radical Islam. Why are we fighting ISIS again? She said the decision to terminate the arms agreement was in line with Sweden's feminist foreign policy, which she introduced after taking office October 2014. Sweden's stance comes at a cost. Former Swedish Foreign Minister Carl Bildt argued Wallström's decision will negatively affect Swedish interests in the Middle East, likely referring to the $550 million Sweden made from 2011 to 2014 from previous arms deals. A group of more than 30 corporations, including Volvo and H&M, condemned the decision in an open letter, arguing Sweden's credibility as a trade partner rested on extending the deal. Saudi Arabia temporarily withdrew its ambassador from Sweden. Marsh argues that while the Swedish decision was unique, its principle could be replicated. He said, "The Swedish decision allowed a particular process that probably couldn't be copied, but I think the state should implement their commitments regarding respect for human rights. If that means antagonizing Saudi Arabia and risking arms contracts, then human rights should not be overridden by financial or economic interests. After all, while Canada is gaining a contract, it's trading away its principles, apparently the pillar of the government's foreign policy. One of Canada's stated foreign policy priority is to, quote, promote democracy and respect for human rights. It was these and what Harper government condemned as barbaric acts of ISIS, like beheading, as a reason, no, the necessity for Canadian military intervention in Iraq and Syria. Yet, in Saudi Arabia, Canada's largest trading party in the Middle East, it is illegal to form or belong to a political party. In 2014, the state carried out 83 beheadings. Every year, thousands of people are subjected to arbitrary arrest and torture. A further Canadian foreign policy priority is to promote religious freedoms. Remember the newly minted Office of Religious Freedoms the Harper introduced? In Saudi Arabia, a country described as having a common interest on many peace and security issues with Canada, well, public worship by adherents of religions other than Islam is banned. Harper has personally championed campaigns for maternal and child health, as well as ending early and forced marriage. concurrently his government in seeking to diversify its relations with Saudi Arabia, a country where women are not allowed to attend a doctor's appointment without a male relative, fathers can legally choose their daughters' husbands, and the Grand Mufti has blocked efforts to create laws to protect girls from early marriage. Canada's principal foreign policy is one of empty rhetoric for profit, while Sweden's feminist approach has challenged assumptions that economics can trump all. Again, another call. 2015. Never forget. We'll return after this break.
Open Media International is a non-profit, non-partisan organization working towards informed, citizen-driven internet policy. Open Media believes in keeping the internet uncensored, open, innovative, secure, and providing universal access to fast and affordable networks. If you would like Open Media to keep campaigning for citizens and internet policy, you can donate to them at openmedia.org or openmedia.ca. You can also find them on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Google+.
Okay, we're back. I've many times stated that the CBC is a vital, important, foundational part of Canada. So it only seems proper to parrot the CBC via the ad issue about the politics of fear. Let's listen in.
Well, remember FDR's famous line, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. Well, apparently that doesn't apply in Canada in 2015, where fear is being pushed as election bait. Look at this Conservative Party Facebook post. Basically, be afraid, be very afraid. But along the way, sign the petition of support. Andrew, Bruce, and Chantel are here, and with extra time tonight as Rex is away, Jennifer Ditchburn from the Ottawa Bureau of the Canadian Press is with us as well. That ad over the top or not, Andrew?
I think we want to avoid being too dainty about it. I mean, politics preys on fears all the time. I've certainly seen worse than that. There's a legitimate issue at the core of it, which is that there are terrorists who are out to get us. There is a bill that they have brought forward that you can criticize, and many people have, but it's their response to that perceived threat. There's going to be an election in which that's going to be front and center. Help us, you Tory supporters, help us defend that bill. I think it's in the details that it really starts to go a little bit awry, which is, you know, naming the Edmonton West Mall, the West Edmonton Mall, the details of the photograph, et cetera, take it a bit beyond, certainly beyond the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. It takes it beyond kind of calm resolution into hair on fire panic, and that's where they lose people, I think.
Chantel?
It's so shrill that it is the shrillness you would expect from a party that is at the tail end of an election campaign and really not doing well. And that's when you start seeing things that are over the top. I don't disagree with Andrew's arguments that this is part and parcel of the debate that we're into and there is an election coming. But to collect money with, you know, this kind of picture in the West Edmonton Mall is so over the top that you have to think some high school class is kind of drafting these, let's have anything that comes to our head and put it there. And it is part of a trend. I mean, on the latest announcements on law and order, the title is There Are Murderers on Our Streets. Mm-hmm. God, I want an escort, military escort to come here next week. Just in case.
What's next? Yeah. The zombie apocalypse. I was thinking, okay, murderers in my neighborhood and the subject line of the email. What's next? But remember the last election, and I sat through so many speeches by Stephen Harper during that, it was that there was a sea of troubles lapping at our shores. So we're going into a second election campaign where it's sort of based on fear. It was back then it was the economy, the global economy, and this scary coalition of the NDP, the Liberals, and the separatists, right? So the question, I guess, is whether it can work a second time based on this. And perhaps it's a little bit shakier. That are people really that afraid that terrorists are coming to their local mall or that there's a murderer living beside them in their neighborhood?
Or that the opposition will open the door to all of them.
Yeah, exactly. That surely is what they're trying to play. Bruce?
Well, I think it shows pretty poor judgment on the part of the Conservatives. I think in the first instance, it publicizes the idea of a terrorist attack on a public facility, and people would be entitled, I think, to wonder if that is something that helps make them safer. I think the second thing is that it looks self-interested rather than public interested. In effect, the party is saying, be scared and do something, by the way, to help us win as a consequence. maybe more importantly, and why the conservatives might want to avoid these kind of tactics going forward, is the PM is making some progress, I think, at looking like a serious custodian of this serious issue. And something like this really undermines the notion that this is serious. It looks like just another political game. And if the conservatives look as though they're trying to have it both ways, that they're playing political games around this issue while at the same time trying to convince people that there is a grave threat and you need serious people in charge to deal with that threat, they'll regret that if they do more of that kind of thing.
All right. Mind you, it's been attacked for the last 3 days that it's out there and it's still there. I mean, they haven't pulled it down, so they must feel that it works.
Well, although some conservatives are not happy with it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
MPs,
even with some
MPs are coming out to say, you know, this, and I'm thinking the West Edmonton Mall and the Edmonton City Council, go down the list, can't be happy about this.
Right.
Wouldn't think so. All right, you mentioned murderers. Well, we have an answer on murderers, too, because yesterday the Prime Minister announces that it's now going to be a life sentence, is going to be a life sentence, unless you can, after 35 years, make an appeal on your case. But you've got to make it now, not to the National Parole Board, but to the federal cabinet. Here's how the Prime Minister outlined it.
Now, let me be clear. This is not parole. Unlike parole, decisions will not rest with an appointed board, but with the federal cabinet. Men and women fully accountable to their fellow citizens and to the families of the victims of these crimes.
Well, you got to go back to 1959, the last time the cabinet had anything to do with these kind of decisions. Jennifer, what do you make of this?
I see sort of a contradiction between their position on the anti-terror bill and this one. So in the anti-terror bill, they're saying, trust the judges. The judges are going to make sure that the intelligence agencies aren't overstepping their bounds. In this case, they want to take the power away from a tribunal that's specifically impartial. The minister can't direct the National Parole Board to do X, Y, or Z. They want to take it away from the tribunal and put it in the cabinet. And as we all know, decisions get made in the cabinet room, and they're not all based on public service and altruistic ideals. They're sometimes based on, I need to get elected, I'm in trouble in my riding, I'm getting killed on this issue, so let's make a decision based on that. I mean, I hate to say it, but that happens. So we're going to transfer the power over people's prison sentences into a place that's completely unaccountable. We have no eyes inside the cabinet room.
You know, it's unfortunate in a way, but this year you have to look at everything through the prism of an election. So you look at this and you say, is this really about law enforcement or is this all about politics?
This is all about politics, but in this case, it's gone through legislation. I mean, I feel much more strongly about this than that ad, which was rhetoric. Mm. This is a policy. This is legislation. The issue is not whether there are some prisoners who are too dangerous to ever be released into the public. Of course there are, and that's the case now. They're kept in prison for the rest of life. The issue is whether all of them are, because effectively, aside from this incredibly faint hope that maybe a sitting politician on the cusp of an election would release a heinous criminal into the, you know, it's not going to happen. So it's effectively, they're saying any prisoner convicted of these crimes will be locked up until they die. That's a remarkable departure from practice in this country for the past several decades, and it deserves to be very thoroughly debated. Bruce?
Well, it's hard to believe on one level, Peter, that after this many years in office, it somehow has just come to the attention of the cabinet that there's a problem with heinous criminals being cut loose. So the idea that this now is an emerging public policy priority really does make one want to raise an eyebrow a little bit. I guess I also feel like what the government's really trying to do here is to taunt the opposition parties into positions that look as though they're less concerned with the safety of Canadians, whether it's about terrorism or whether it's about criminals here in Canada, and to put the opposition leaders in a real quandary, whether they want to pick those fights, whether they want to appear to be or allow themselves to be put in a position where they're looking like they're arguing for some possibility of a reasonable treatment for somebody who committed some horrible crime. I think they'd be wise, politically anyway, to avoid that. But by the same token, the idea, we don't elect judges here, the idea that we're going to change fundamental policy is going to beg the opposition parties, I think, to take issue with some of that anyway.
I find it hard to believe that Canadians will not give a hearing to the other side of the argument on this, because it is so obviously driven by politics. One academic called it, I think the description was the best description, a solution in search of a problem. I also find it interesting because it's part of a larger pattern which involves the Conservatives no longer crafting laws with lawyers helping them to make sure that they have charter-proof legislation, but rather coming up with legislation that is either over the line or on the line and daring the courts to overturn it and then turning around to say, you see, the courts have again undone us. I'm not sure that that's a way to govern that can be sustained over the long run. It certainly makes the relationship between the courts, the rule of law, and the government more stressful. But it also seems to me like this government is building a case one morning to use the notwithstanding clause and start skirting the charter, having accumulated enough defeats that it is seeking with bills that, on the looks of them, will not be sustained by the courts.
And unfortunately, the court has to some extent given them some ammo on some of these. I think they've made some wonky rulings, but I take your point certainly that this is reckless. This is a deliberate attempt to court, as you say, a finding of unconstitutionality. You should not be drafting legislation that you know is going to be thrown out. Mm-hmm. That's just basic statecraft. And to do so, as I say, on the basis of there's some epidemic of people being released after 25 years in jail, when they can probably barely stand upright after which, and they're, you know, somehow out there menacing our streets. It's just demonstrably not true.
All right. Shift focus here for one other topic before we take a quick break. And it's about Justin Trudeau. He was last night in Vancouver, UBC, talking to students and found himself in a Q&A session with those students. And the topic of conversation for a good chunk of the time was Bill C-51, the anti-terror bill. And he was being challenged. I want you to listen to a bit of this. Thanks to CKNW, our friends at the radio station in Vancouver, who gave us their audio copy and pictures from the UBC, the UBC paper. Here's just a short excerpt of what happened. Listen to this.
Yes. 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 No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you for expressing your concern. And I've heard this. We've heard this from Canadians, and I share those concerns about this bill. And that's why the pressure that you and everyone else are putting on this government is getting them to understand that if they don't bring in oversight, if they don't bring in review, if they don't narrow the overly broad provisions in this bill, they're going to have a very difficult time in the next election campaign convincing Canadians that they're worthy of their trust.
All right, so that's part of the exchange. Some of the reporters who were there wanted to talk to Mr. Trudeau afterwards, but he said he didn't have time. The question I've got is he finding himself now trying to defend his position as opposed to dealing with C-51 in these kind of Q&A sessions, and is that a sense of what we may be looking at in terms of an election campaign, Bruce?
Yes, I think so. I think it probably does speak a little bit to his relative inexperience as leader of a party competing in an election where he has a chance to win. I think we're going to see more situations where he's going to find himself in a quandary where his opponent's agenda is going to be the one that's on the table, that's in front of him, that he feels obliged to respond to. And of course, all of the best strategic advice that he could get in a campaign is don't let that be the focus of what you're doing. His problem right now is he hasn't yet laid out exactly what his campaign is going to be about, so he doesn't have the opportunity to pivot and say, that's a good point. Here's what we're going to do with that law. Let's talk about something else now. So I think he's hitting some bumps along the road, and this is a taste of what the Conservatives have in store for him, I think.
Jennifer.
Well, it makes you wonder whether there's any room anymore in Canadian politics for a gray area, and I think he's finding perhaps that the room is evaporated to almost nothing, or you can't sort of be in the middle of two fences. You have to take a very definitive position, which is maybe not great, but that's just the reality. But I would say at least he puts himself in venues where he will take question negative type questions, which is not always the case for other leaders. So I don't know. I think, it, as Bruce mentioned, it's going to be difficult for him on this particular bill for sure in the next little while.
Andrew?
I think the calculation was that they just don't want the Tories to be able to say you voted against that bill. If you look in functional, practical terms, there's no real difference between the Liberal and the NDP position on this. The NDP position is the bill is half empty. The NDP Liberal position is it's half full. The NDP would vote against it but would not repeal it. They just amendment. The Liberals would vote for it and then change it afterwards. So you wind up at the same place in the end. But they're playing to different audiences. The NDP is playing to the more hardcore anti-conservative, anti-C-51 vote. The Liberals want to be able to get that security-minded voter but be softer about it. The problem with all that cleverness that the Liberal positioning is you wind up doing what we just discussed, which is voting for a bill that you know is has unconstitutional provisions in it, and saying, well, the Supreme Court will clean up the mess afterwards, or we'll clean up the mess afterwards if we get elected. That's problematic, I guess.
All right, I got to take that break that I was talking about. But when we come back, we'll have this for at issue, this question. The Duffy trial, remember that? Starts in a month. What's the latest on the Duffy story?
That line was written by the PMO to deceive Canadians as to the real source of the $90,000.
Okay, we're back. Get used to all those terms again, because you'll be hearing them when the trial starts for Mike Duffy next month. Back at the table, Chantel, Andrew, Bruce, and Jennifer, they're all here. Rosie Barton, as you saw again tonight, had another story this week in terms of what to expect when that trial starts, some of the ways that it appears the RCMP has been tracking Duffy and trying to determine how they're going to press the charges. Jennifer, you've been writing about this as well. What should we expect?
Well, I mean, what I'm interested in the trial, there's a couple of tracks. One is the PMO staff and that window into the culture inside the Prime Minister's office. What made them think it was okay to try to influence an independent audit, to try to whitewash a Senate report? We're going to be hearing, presumably, from some of those staffers. The other thing I think that hasn't been given a lot of attention is around this expenses issue. Mike Duffy's always maintained that he was within the rules, within the Senate rules. And I think there will be a very interesting debate within that trial, but also in the Senate, because they're all under the scrutiny of an auditor, right, of the Auditor General, as to whether the rules actually were too vague or there was too much gray area, and whether he did anything differently than, let's say, another senator would have done in his caucus or another caucus. And I think that we're going to hear a lot of discussion in the courtroom about how specific the rules were.
You know, there was enormous interest in this story when it first broke for a considerable length of time after that. One wonders if the trial turns into this kind of debate over taxi receipts and hotel rooms, how much interest will continue on.
It's true that we will probably get some insights into the PMO, but the focus will change dramatically from question period. In question period, it was all about the PMO and Stephen Harper and how it works. This is about Mike Duffy. And the people from the PMO who are going to be there are going to be asked questions about Mike Duffy. He is the center of this, and that focus makes it, frankly, less interesting. Not that it's not a great story, but it is, I think once you get there, it's no longer about the Prime Minister and the PMO. It's about a senator that I think many people have decided was an errant senator. Whether he interpreted the rules loosely or broke the law, that's an open question. But that focus makes it less of a politically explosive story, I think.
Unless somebody dropped something that none of us were expecting.
Well, and it depends what Duffy and his lawyers do, because they may wish to shift the focus a bit. Certainly that in his speeches in the Senate floor, he was certainly making it about them and about what they told him to do, what they made him do. If there's any, I think, explosive thing in this beyond, you know, the hot question of what did the Prime Minister know, which I doubt we'll find out, it's why were all those senior Tories so desperate to make this not very significant senator happy? Why were they going to such lengths to, quote-unquote, make him whole and to get him the money and to keep him quiet? And Mr. Duffy may have secrets to tell about that, or he may not, but we'll find out. Bruce?
Well, I think the question in my mind is whether or not Mr. Duffy is really approaching this trial looking to prove his innocence or share some guilt with others. And I don't mean guilt necessarily in a legal sense, but culpability for what happened. It's probably a reasonable bet to assume that his lawyer is giving him advice that says, look, job number one is to keep you from being convicted. Now, I don't know whether he'll be convicted or not, but I imagine that it's impossible that his reputation will be improved as a result of this trial. For the government, I think the stakes are really about, there's only so many weeks left in this political calendar between now and the election. How many weeks do they really want to have this be the sound that's coming out of Ottawa? Regardless of whether there are any great big news items that we haven't heard of before, people will be talking about it, and that means it'll be crowding out some of the other things that the government wants to talk about.
Well, I guess we're only a few weeks away from finding out the answers to those. Jennifer, great of you to join us again this week.
Okay, that's about all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.